stand for a man who has helped many thousands of people, including myself, one more day of sobriety. Well, please.
My name is Bob, and I'm a drunk. If you hear the night, you're a drunk in the right
place.
How you doing? Hi. I'd like to congratulate the group on their second anniversary. I don't like to speak. Let me say that up front. Everybody who knows me, I always start out saying that, and I wind up talking for about an hour and a half. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is for drunks. If you're here tonight and you're a drunk, like I say, you're in the right place. I had a lot of trouble with booze. I believe in the big book of AA. Right? People come to AA to talk about a lot of other things. I believe they're talking about alcohol. Right? Alcohol destroyed me. It destroyed a lot of other people, too, right? You know, that came in contact with me. And I had more than my fair share. By the time I got here at the age of 28, I'd been arrested, hospitalized, and institutionalized. I've been locked in, locked up, and locked out. I've been in my house trying to get out. I've been out of my house trying to get in. I'd had the shakes, the sweats, the dry heaves, the wet heaves, the DTs, the horrors. I've been arrested in every major city east of the Mississippi River I've been in, because I've been in most of them. I was covered with wine sores from head to foot. I was sleeping in doorways and parked cars, Goodwill boxes, wherever I could sleep. That was my bottom, sleeping in Goodwill boxes. Right? I remember I was sleeping in a Goodwill box on Aiken Avenue in Lowell one time, and I went over there one night, and I went to get in, and there was another guy in the box. and he told me to leave, and he was bigger than I was. That's what you call total rejection, you see, right? I know that it's difficult for a person coming here for the first time or the first few times to identify. They compare. When I first came here, I was told to identify and not compare. I didn't even know what the hell the word meant. I know that most people who come to AA don't want to be alcoholics. They're hoping against hope that they're not an alcoholic. I was hoping against hope I wasn't. I didn't mind being a drunk because drunks drink. And I know that you can continue to drink if you're a drunk, you see, right? You know, because I see all the drunks and they drink, right? But alcoholics are supposed to stop. I didn't like that. When I came here, I remember somebody telling me there's a thin line that you cross over between social drinking and alcoholism, you know, and I was kind of hoping I hadn't crossed the line, you know. And I told my sponsor, I said, I don't remember going over that line. And he said, well, don't worry about it. You were probably drunk at the time. And I know now that the line happened way back early in my drinking, and I wouldn't have known I crossed over it anyway. I was never a social drinker. I was always an alcoholic. I was born a drunk. The only thing I had to do to become a bona fide alcoholic was pick up a drink, and obviously I did that or I wouldn't have been here tonight. But a great many people, you know, hope they're not alcoholics. You know, they hope that they've caught this thing in time. They don't want to go over that line, you see. And I understand that. Right? A lot of people, when they come to AA, find it extremely difficult to stop drinking, right? They stop for a day, 2 days, 3 days, maybe a week, a month, or whatever it may be, and they go back to it because they're not willing to pay the price. You know, that's why they say the only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. Now, you don't have to have a burning desire to stop drinking. You don't have to have all fired up, you know, enthusiastic, desires. But you got to have some kind of a desire to do something about your booze problem. And in order to do something about your booze problem, the first thing you have to do is admit you got one. And so I believe that the toughest thing you have to do coming to AA is get honest with yourself. You know, a lot of other people can tell you have a drunk. I can stand up here and tell you have a drunk, but unless you admit that you're having trouble with booze, there's not much hope for you. Right? You've got to somewhere along the line admit that you are having trouble with alcohol. And once you've admitted that, right, you know, then there's hope for you, right? There's hope for you for one day. There's not hope for you for the rest of your life. You know, that's why I say, you know, when people get up here at AA and talk about other things other than booze is the most important thing we should talk about. I mean, you know, if you want to talk about grave emotional disturbances and, you know, sex problems and marital problems and money problems, you know, you're looking at the wrong guy. I don't know anything about those things. I probably got them all, but I don't know anything about them. I know it's a disease. I know that the medical profession knows nothing about the disease whatsoever. They know that that medically there's something that happens inside of a human body to an alcoholic that doesn't happen in non-alcoholics, right? But that isn't the solution to the problem, right? You know, psychology and psychiatry, they'll tell you there's something that happens in the mind of an alcoholic that doesn't happen in other alcoholics, but that doesn't solve the problem either. And theologians and clergymen will tell you that something happens with the spirit of an alcoholic, but that doesn't solve the problem, because the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We have clergymen, psychologists, psychiatrists, and doctors in here, and they come in here for one reason, to find out how to stop drinking and stay sober for one day at a time. So if you're here tonight for the first time or the first few times, chances are you're a drunk. I mean, it's a good shot you might be a drunk. I've never seen anybody show up at an AA meeting by mistake. I've seen them leave AA meetings by mistake and never come back, but I've never seen them show up at an AA meeting by mistake. Chances are you're having trouble with booze. Now, I think anybody who comes into an AA hall probably has that in their head. They say, geez, I'm having some trouble with booze. But here's where you get into the semantics of the thing. They say, but to what degree am I having trouble with booze? Well, social drinkers don't have trouble with booze to any degree. You know, either you're a social drinker or you got trouble with booze. And if you got a little trouble with booze, maybe you got the whole ball of wax. You bought the farm if you got a little trouble. You know, it's like a woman being pregnant, you know, right? You know, she's not a little bit pregnant, you know. She's either pregnant or she isn't pregnant, you know. Now, in the first 15 minutes after her, you know, conception and the pregnancy, she ain't too sure. And there's probably only a couple of people who think that may be, you see, right? And obviously in the last month, the whole goddamn world knows, you know, right? But, you know, she's still pregnant all the way down along the line. She's still got that thing, and you know, I have never been pregnant. But it seems to me that when a woman is pregnant, you know, she must somehow, when she finds out she's pregnant, she must have some way in her mind, she must say, geez, I got that thing. I got to get rid of that thing. You know, it's going to be born, right? You know, I mean, you can't avoid it, you see, right? You know, the ultimate, you know, you've either got to abort the thing or you've got to have the baby, but there's no way you can get out of it, you see, right? You know, something's got to happen. It's the same thing with alcoholism, right? Once you've contracted this disease, you're a full-termer, you know. There are no degrees of alcoholism. There are degrees of trouble that you can get into through alcoholism, right? I told you the things that happened to me very briefly in the beginning, but those are not prerequisites for membership in AA. The only requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking. There are literally thousands upon thousands of people who are dead today who never panhandled. You know, they died of alcoholism, they're planted in their grave, they're 6 feet under, and they never panhandled. You know, they never had the DTs, they never got arrested. A lot of them never lost their license. They never lost their family. They never lost their job. But they died of alcoholism. Probably because they were waiting for one of those things to happen. That might be a little, you know, signpost to the fact that they were having trouble with booze. This is an insidious disease. And it's a fatal disease. And there is no cure for the disease. So if you're here tonight and you're having a little trouble with booze, you're having a lot of trouble with booze. You got a fatal disease. You know, and it's amazing, you know, that an alcoholic doesn't want to admit he's got it. You know, a lot of alcoholics are hypochondriacs. You know, they worry about everything. You know, right? You know, they got a pain in the side, they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, you know, nothing, little, you know, gas pain, you know. They go to 3 more doctors to make sure it isn't cancer. You know, they believe it. It's got to be cancer, you know. They got a shooting pain in their chest, they think it's a heart attack, you know. You know, they go to 4 or 5 doctors, you know, they have cardiograms and everything else. They all tell them the same thing. There's nothing the matter with your heart. They don't believe it. You know, they go home and tell their friends, I know he's lying. I got 6 months to live. To walk up to a bona fide, 100% guaranteed, authentic drunk and tell him he's an alcoholic, and you'll say, hell no, I ain't got that. Right? And the reason he says, hell no, I ain't got that, is because he knows what the cure is. You stay away from a drink. And alcoholics defend their right to drink. And they defend their right to drink to the death. I should have come to AA a long time before I come to AA, but I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I knew I was a drunk. I picture an alcoholic as an old guy, maybe 55, 60 years old. That's not too old, but you know. I mean, you guys that are 62, I don't mean to offend you. I always pictured an alcoholic as being a man, you see. I never knew there were women alcoholics before I came to AA. I should have. I drank with enough of them, but I... I didn't know it, right? You know, but I pictured him as the typical wino, laying in a doorway someplace with holes in his shoes and holes in his pants and a wine bottle on the hip. Now, that's not an alcoholic. I mean, that's an alcoholic, maybe, but that's not, you know, that's the caricature of an alcoholic. That's what an artist would draw if you asked him to draw a picture of an alcoholic. And yet only 3% of the people in AA come from Skid Row. The rest of them are walking, talking, working drunks. You know, they hide the bottles. They struggle to go to work every day. I really think I had it easy coming into AA, actually, when you come right down to it, because I was a Skid Row bum. You know, I don't know how it would be to work and drink. You know, I can't make those two things come together. I'm sure there's a lot of people in the hall tonight that work and drink, right? That work and drank, but you know, I could never do that. You know, when I committed myself to alcohol, I went all the way. You know. And, I said, what the hell, I'm a drunk, I'll drink. You don't, when you're drinking, like I drank, you don't have time to work. If you could find anybody that would hire you in the first place, right? I took my first drink, I was in the entertainment business, right? I was born nervous. You gotta understand that. Before. And I will always be nervous. You know, people in AA talk about nerves like, you know, nowadays, like, you know, it's a sin to be nervous. You know, don't worry, you'll stop shaking. Don't ever tell a newcomer they'll stop shaking. Maybe they'll never stop shaking. You know, if they don't stop shaking, they can still take sober. You know, they'll get used to the shakes. That's what they'll do, right? And some morning they'll get up and they won't be shaking, you know, and that'll make them nervous and they'll start shaking. But I was born nervous. I had a lot of strikes against me in this life. Looking back on it, the way I see it, you see, the way I see it, very briefly, the first strike I had against me, I was born a Baptist. Now, this is an Irish Catholic disease. I want to thank you for letting me in. I pictured God like a death sergeant. See, I had a very strong fear of God, and I figured when I died, you know, I was going to meet God, and He was going to say how good. He had a book there, you know, and He kept track of the things I did wrong, and I was going to walk up to Him. He's going to say, what's your name? I'd tell him, he'd say, let me check the book there. Oh, very bad, very bad, right? Send me to a place called hell, ruled over by a guy by the name of the devil. And he would hold me over an open fire, you know, in the end of a pitchfork. Not until I was medium rare, but forever. Now, if you believe this, you see, you know, you're scared, right? You're scared. And in the Baptist faith, the only way you can avoid this is by, you know, doing nothing wrong. Of course, the kicker is in the Baptist faith, you can't do anything right. You know, everything you do is wrong. You can't play for cheesy on Sunday, you know, there's nothing. And the top of the list is you don't drink, see? My mother used to say anybody who drinks will do anything. And she's right. You know, anybody who drinks will do anything. So that was my first hang-up, was religion. And it was a big hang-up. I had a lot of fears. And I was an insecure, very fearful person when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, right? You know? My second strike against me, I was born a twin, right, you know, and I have a twin brother, and we started out together. When you're twins, you do start out together, and my brother was a very intellectual, very, very sharp kid, and he was a little Lord Fauntleroy type, you know, and he grew up to be a big Lord Fauntleroy type, but that's another story, right? But everybody loved my brother, and in school I got compared with my brother. You know, twins get compared. We were identical twins, and we dressed alike, you know, which was a little strange, but... People used to come up to me and say, Bob, why can't you be like your brother? I didn't want to be like my brother. You know, I didn't necessarily care for my brother. I suppose you love your brother because he's your brother, but if I was going to choose a guy to hang around with, I wouldn't have chosen my brother. So, I don't see him much right now, as a matter of fact, which proves that, you know, I really, he's a nice enough guy, I'm not knocking him, but, you know, he's not my type of guy, right? I don't know how I can say it any clearer, right? But I thought that, you know, because everybody said, why can't you be like your brother, and I thought that maybe that's what you had to be to get acceptance in this world, and I wanted acceptance like everybody wanted acceptance, so I tried very hard to be like my brother. Now, when you do that, you got... You know, two things happen to you. The first thing is you become a phony. You know, no question about it, you become a phony. Because you know, you're living somebody else's life. You're not yourself. So you're a phony. And the second thing that happens is you become a perfectionist, because obviously everybody thought my brother was perfect, so, you know, I had to strive for perfection. So here I am, like 9, 10 years old, you know, and I'm fearful, I'm nervous, I'm guilty, I'm remorseful, right? I'm a perfectionist, right? I'm a phony. Am I in trouble? I'm not out of the third grade yet, and I'm in deep shit. You know, if I was walking by, I can best describe it like this. If you had a diagram of what a 9-year-old kid's head should look like inside, you know, and I walked by with a transparent head, you'd do a double. You'd say, hey, there's something the matter with his head. You know, because there was. My head was not on straight. You know, I didn't feel like I was a member of the human race. I felt like I was different. There was something the matter with me. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't know what it was. But you're not supposed to have anxiety attacks and nervous attacks and be insecure and all this in the fourth and fifth and sixth grade, you know? So there's two strikes against me. And, of course, I had no faith, you see, because you have to have faith in something, because if you don't have faith, you have fear. It's as simple as that. If you don't have faith in something, it's a two-sided coin. On one side of the coin is faith, on the other side is fear. You got to have faith in something. And I had faith in nothing. I didn't even know why I was born, right? Now, the third strike is I at a young age, I decided to be a musician, right? And I studied hard, I became a good musician, right? You know, but I was afraid to get out in front of people. I couldn't get out in front of people, you know? And they don't pay you for playing the men's room. And so one night on a nightclub stage, right? I fainted from bad nerves, without a drink. I fainted. And a bartender took me up the back of the hall, gave me a double shot of booze. He put it in a glass, he said, here, sip it, it'll make you feel better. And I drank that booze. I don't know how old I was. I can remember it like it was yesterday. I took the drink and I poured it down. It was raw whiskey and it burned all the way down, like it got down to about here. When I got to about here, there was a little explosion. A nice explosion, you know? And the warmth of that explosion went up into my shoulders and down into my arms, and the warmth went around my back, you know, and it went down into my legs, and the warmth come up into my head. You know, with every bit of this warmth that went through me, I could feel all the pressure and the tension and then the anxiety and the fear. All the trouble just draining right out. And I felt great for the first time in my life. And that's the reason I'm here tonight. If a woman had done that to me, I would have been a sex maniac, you know? I thought at the time that was the answer to all my problems. I really did. I thought that was the answer. I said, that's the piece that's been missing in the puzzle. It was like a gigantic picture puzzle with one piece missing. And this was the piece. This was the thing that was going to make me a whole person. I didn't have to give up the music business. I didn't have to go through life feeling different than people. I didn't have to have nervous attacks. I didn't have to have palpitations. I didn't have to have clammy, sweaty hands. All I had to do was have a couple of pops, and the warmth would go through me, and I'd feel good. I got drunk that night. No? I don't know how I got back to the hotel room or wherever I was staying. I got up the next morning, I got drunk the next morning. I picked up a bottle the next morning, see if it worked in the morning. It works just as good in the morning as it does in the afternoon. I took the cap off the bottle that morning, threw the cap away. I had no intentions of putting the cap back on that bottle. You know, I bought it to drink it, not to look at it. And I drank it. And from that day till the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, some 10 years later, right, I never was without it unless I was in a position where I couldn't get it. Never. That night, I found a place to put my fears. I found faith in something. I had total, complete, and absolute faith in alcohol. And because I had total, complete, absolute faith in alcohol, it took away my fears. As long as I was drunk. But you can't stay drunk. People are always getting in your way. Cops get in your way. Your wife gets in your way. You run out of money. Nobody gives you any credit. You know, you just can't stay drunk. You know, I've always said it in AA meeting. I had no trouble when I was drunk. You know, a lot of other people had trouble when I was drunk. But I had no trouble. No, I was calm and relaxed. I had total serenity when I was drunk. Most of us did, you say, right? You know, hell with it, man. right? Who cares, right? You know, I didn't care if there was a war on, or if there, you know. Let me have another drink. You know, as long as I could stay in that position, I had no problems. Oh, I had a great many problems, but I didn't know it, you see. And I thought that I had to stay that way in order to live. Now, I took my first drink because I was nervous. I told you, I passed out from nerves without ever, you know. Is that nervous? That's pretty nervous. I can sum up my drinking by just simply telling you this, right? I took my first drink when I was nervous, because I was nervous. And the more I drank, the more nervous I became. And the more nervous I became, the more I drank. And the more I drank, the more nervous I became. And the more nervous I became, the more I drank. And the more I drank, the more nervous I became. And the more nervous I became, the more I am. When I came in here 10 years later, I was very nervous. Everything in my life was gone when I came in here 10 years later. Everything in my life was gone. There was nothing left. My wife was gone. My home was gone. My career was gone. My teeth were gone. Those are for me. Everything was gone. Anything you needed to work with. My mind would not work. My body would not function. Spiritually, I was bankrupt. I owed thousands of dollars. Nothing. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous because I had no other place to go. I was a sick drunk, and I was hoping I wasn't an alcoholic. But I was an alcoholic. Everybody knew it. You know, everybody who saw me knew it. The police department. You know, I had been walking the streets of Lowell. I had my own cell in the Lowell jail down on Market Street. You know. I remember one time on a Friday or a Saturday or a Thursday, I imagine it was a weekend night because that's usually when I spent my time down there. You know, one of the local cops in Lowell picked me up down the South End. I remember it very vividly, right? It was a warm night. He picked me up. And I told him, I said, "Hey, Duke, I'm not even drunk." He says, "No, but you will be. It'll save us a trip." Everybody knew me. You know, I was one of the fleet, one of the town drunks, you know, one of the guys. You know, I was harmless, you see, you know, but at the time it was against the law to be drunk. And so I got arrested a lot of times. I don't know how many times. I hear people stand up here and give a chronological, you know, accounting of how many. I have no idea how many times. The police in Lowell don't have any idea how many times I got arrested. Or in other places either, you know. My life was a turmoil. I wanted to kill myself, but I was afraid to die, you see. I wanted to die, but I didn't want to die. You know how I figured it? I figured if I could get drunk enough, I could die and not know I was dead. You see, that was my biggest fear of all, see, was dying. Because I knew then, you know, the old book's going to come out, you know, what's your name, right? I figured if I get drunk enough, I might be able to spend eternity, you know, in a mucus condition, right? You know, the flames would not be as hot or something, right? You know, I had fears, I had terror, I had panic. I can't describe it. There's no way to describe terror. No way to describe it. If I didn't have a drink in my possession, I was an absolute maniac. I had to have a drink. You know, and if I didn't have a drink, my mind would race, my heart would pound, you know. It was horrendous. Horrendous. And I started looking for help before I came into AA. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I started looking for help. I went to a Baptist minister. I figured, you know, maybe I got away from the church and I'm being punished, see? So I went and saw a Baptist minister. And I told him I was an alcoholic. I told him I was a drunk. And I didn't have to tell him. He knew, right? And he said to me, and I remember what he said to me. He said to me, "My son," they always start off like that. He said, "My son, Christ will lead you across the turbulent waters to the distant shore." It's a hell of a thing to tell a drunk, right? I didn't even know what the hell he was talking about. And I got out of there in a hurry. I figured I didn't need any more fruitcakes from out, you know? I know what he meant today. Today, you know, looking back, I don't know why he did it in mumbo-jumbo. I don't know why he didn't come right out and say there's a power. There's powers for the good and powers for the bad. There's a power in this world that if you call upon that power, you can get the strength you need to stay sober. I don't know why he didn't tell me that, but he didn't. Then I went and saw a Catholic priest, you know, because I had been sleeping in a lot of doorways with Catholics. There are some Catholics in the doorways. And they always told me they were, you know, they had a better in with God than I did because they were Catholics, you see, right? And they seemed to think that the priests were more knowledgeable than the ministers, and why didn't I go see a priest? So I went and I saw a Catholic priest, see? And I told them my tale of woe. I told them, I said, you know, I was a musician. I was a good musician. I played around the country in name bands. I made a lot of dough. You know, that career is gone. I worked as a comic traveling around the country, made a lot of money. Right? That career is gone. I've had some good jobs. I've lost my home. I've lost my family. I've lost my car. I've lost my license. I've lost. I'm full of terror. I'm full of fear. I've had DTs. I'm afraid I'm going into a convulsion again, this and that. And I told him my whole tale of woe. I told him, I said, I'm only 28 years old, 27 years old, or whatever I was at the time. I said, and booze has done it all. And he looked at me and he said, why don't you stop drinking? That's a good question, isn't it, huh? You know, when you think about it, you know, when you think about all the heartaches, you know, that we've gone through, all the trouble we've gone through, you know, I hear people stand up here and say, alcoholics are super sensitive, highly intellectual individuals, you know, that's a crock, right? Alcoholics are self-willed run riot. They tend to be very selfish pigs who drink too much. There's nothing romantic about alcoholism, you know. Nothing romantic. You know, you can break it down to this kind of a thing. I picture for a minute a vat on this side of the stage over here. A big, huge, enormous vat. A tank. You know? Now inside that tank, right, tonight, we'll pour all the alcohol that anybody in this room has drank over the course of their entire life. And it will fill that tank. Now, I mean, there'll be high-class stuff in there. There'll be rubby-dub. There'll be musky-doo. There'll be Listerine. There'll be Aquavelva. You know, there'll be Red Cap Refresher. You know, there'll be Johnny Walker. There'll be, you know, we'll fill that whole vat over there with all the booze that anybody in this room has consumed. And there's not that many people in this room. This is just a small percentage of the alcoholics in the world, an infinitesimal percentage. But we'll fill that vat with all of it, okay? Now let's put none of that over on the other side of the room. And in this vat, let's put all the puke. Let's put all the runs. I mean, this stuff that we put into ourselves had to come out of us, all right? Let's talk about it for a second, okay? Let's put it all in this vat over here. We're going to fill that vat too, you know, right? We ain't gonna have any trouble filling that vat. Now, can you imagine for a minute? Can you imagine for a minute the cost, right, that it took to take it from there and put it there? The cost in heartache, the cost in tears, the cost in opportunities, the cost in hurt to our loved ones, the cost in remorse and guilt, the cost even in life, to get it from here and put it over there. And we didn't use, you know, a simple pipe with a pump. We used the human body. We used our human body. We took all that stuff and drained it through our kidneys and our livers and everything else to get it over on there. You know, And then I hear people stand up and say alcoholics are super sensitive, highly individualistic, intelligent. You know, alcoholics are crazy. We're nuts. If anybody did to us what we did to ourselves, we could have them arrested and locked up for life. We beat the hell out of ourselves. We beat the hell out of ourselves. We beat the hell out of ourselves emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And yet, when we come in here, and when we're showed away, you get newcomers coming into the hall, or coming back, it's still so difficult to admit, you know, because of our dependency on alcohol. You know, it's still so difficult to admit that we got a problem. Now, I told you, I crawled out of a doorway, a goodwill box. I was gone, man. There was nothing left of me. I will only mention this in passing, in case there is a drug addict out there. Right? I popped pills. I mainlined. I smoked grass. I was a musician. What the hell do you expect? Right? But I was a loyal alcoholic. Right? You know, I like booze better than anything else. I didn't like popping pills. You know, you pop a pill, you have to wait 20 minutes to see if the goddamn thing's going to work. You know, after about 10 minutes, you begin to wonder. You know, you check your throat. Is it gone down? Look in the glass. You know. I like that instant jolt you got from a double hooker. You know, down, you knew you had it. It was there, see? But, you know, I told you all the problems I had, and they were, you know, they were enormous problems, you know, right? Enormous problems. I was as close to being dead as I will ever be. I weighed 103 pounds at the time. 103. There are people in this hall tonight who remember me when I come in. I weighed 103 pounds. I had a 37, 36-inch waist. That was the biggest part of me. I was all blown up. I had wine sores all over me. I was jaundiced. I was yellow. You know. What are you going to do, right? No, I was gone. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous because I won't tell you how I got here. It was a long string of people who finally turned me on to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat down, and mind you, I'm looking for help now. I'm looking for help. I told you, I went to the priest, I went to the minister. I'm looking for help. Now, and finally, I sit down with an alcoholic across from me, and an alcoholic told me his story. And the story he told me is a story that all alcoholics tell to alcoholics. He told me, and it don't make any difference where you drink or how much you drink or who you drink it with or anything else. That has nothing to do with it, you see. Because the story he told me was a story of compulsion. It was a story of fear. He talked to me about fear. He said to me, "Do you know what I'm talking about when I mention fear?" I said, "Oh, yeah, boy. I know what you're talking about when you talk about fear." He says, "Do you know what I'm talking about when I talk about guilt?" I said, "Yeah, I know that, though. How about remorse?" "Yeah, I know what remorse is." "Do you have any idea what loneliness is?" I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "Now, not the loneliness of being alone, but the loneliness of not having anybody understand." I said, "Yeah, I know that, too." Because people had always said to me, my mother said to me, "Can't you see what you're doing to yourself?" And I could never tell it. All kinds of people ask me, "Why do you drink?" That's the typical question they ask. That's the number one question they ask an alcoholic. "Why do you drink?" And an alcoholic has no answer to it, because an alcoholic doesn't know why he drinks. And it doesn't make any difference why he drinks, does it? It makes no difference whatsoever. There's no understanding out there. They don't know. They don't know. They are constantly frustrated and disappointed and let down by the alcoholic because they can't communicate with the alcoholic. But this day I had an alcoholic in front of me, and he told me, he says, "Do you understand that? The loneliness of not being understood." I said, "Yeah, I know. I know what you're talking about." He said, "You know what I'm talking about when I talk about compulsion? Not the way Hollywood depicts compulsion, you know, 42 miles of cut glass and everything else to get to a, you know, just a little voice in the back of the head that says, maybe I better have another one in case." In case of what? Right? But I used to do it. You know, I'd be in a joint at 1 o'clock in the morning, last call, I needed another drink like I needed another armpit. But I'd run up and say, Jimmy, put it in front of me. I guess last call, you know, and then put a little bit in a book. Can I have a jug of, put a little bit in a brown paper bag there, and, you know. Why? Because I was afraid to be without it. A little voice in the back of my head was always saying, don't get caught without booze. Because if you get caught without booze, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be panic struck. That's your friend. Booze is your friend. It's the only thing that's going to get you through the night. It's the only thing that's going to get you through this circumstance. It's the only thing that's going to let you talk to this person, let you get over there, let you get from here to there, let you sleep. It's the only thing. It was my only salvation, booze. I had to have alcohol. He said, do you understand that? I said, yeah, I understand that. He says, you know, if you understand all the things I'm talking about, then chances are you're an alcoholic. He said, and the reason I know is because I'm an alcoholic. But he didn't look like an alcoholic. He did not look like an alcoholic. First of all, he was sober. Obviously. Second of all, he was happy. But most important, he was honest. He was totally honest. I couldn't believe that a guy, you know, all my life I've been looking for a way out. All my life, even before I took a drink, I was looking for a way out. After I took a drink, I was looking for a way out. The more I drank, the worse I became, and I was looking for a way out. Looking for a way out. And here's a guy sitting in front of me, and he says to me, I'm going to show you the way out. And you know something? I believed him. I believed him because he had been there. That's the communication line from one drunk to another. If you're in this hall tonight and you're new or you're coming back, you know, the battle cry of the alcoholic is this. But you don't understand. Don't ever say that in alcoholics, huh? Because if you're here for the first time, we understand. Believe me, we understand. To some degree or other, we've all been there. We do understand. Then he said to me, you come along with us. And I'll show you a new way of life. We do it 24 hours a day. You ask for help in the morning, you thank at night. You do what's ever necessary to keep yourself sober. You do not pick up a drink or a substitute. You do not pick up a drink or a substitute. For 24 hours, you put the cap on the bottle and you pay the price. Whatever that price might be, you pay it. Are you willing to try? I said, yeah. He said, it'll get better. It didn't get better. The first day was bad, the second was worse, the third was worse than that. Right? I couldn't sleep. I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. I hadn't had a job for a long time anyway. You know, they suggested I go out and I get a job. I must have gone through 30 jobs in the first 60 days. I'd get a job, you know, I'd check into a mill someplace to work in a mill, you know? And you know, you start at 8 o'clock, and the guy would say, okay, you get on the machine there. Here's what you do. You pick up those things, and you put them in that barrel over there, right? The guy's going to run the machine. Just pick a thing up and put it in the barrel over there, right? Yeah, you understand what we're doing? I understand what you're doing. No problem. At 8 o'clock, the bell goes off, the machine starts, and terror takes over. I'm trapped, right? I'm in here. I'm trapped. And I'd run out of the place. You know, I probably have, you know, $40, $50 owed to me by 30 companies down there, 15 minutes at a whack, right? You know? I couldn't do a simple thing like getting a haircut. I'd go in and I'd sit down in a barber's chair to get a haircut, you know, and terror would come over me. He'd put the thing around my neck, and, you know, and I'd be sitting there, and halfway through the haircut, you know, I'd get up and I'd leap out of the chair and go running out, you know, with the thing trailing after me like the tail of a comet. Couldn't do it. And then a half an hour later, I'd walk back in, I'd say, finish the haircut. I'd say, finish the haircut, give me back my towel and screw, right? I couldn't sleep at night. I could not sleep at night. I couldn't sleep in the daytime either. I couldn't sleep. I'd almost get to sleep. My nerves were totally destroyed. My nervous system had been annihilated, is what it had been done. You know, I'd almost get to sleep. I'd lie down. There was no sense getting undressed. I'd just lie down on the bed and try to go to sleep. And I'd get like 10 minutes into sleep, you see, right? And all of a sudden, I'd come leaping out of bed. I forgot to breathe, you know? Then then I sit there, because I have an overactive mind anyway, and I convinced myself that the part of my brain that controls my automatic breathing when I'm asleep has been permanently destroyed. And when you've convinced yourself of that, try and go back to sleep. No way, right? No way, right? Meetings were a terrible, terrible ordeal. You know, they didn't go to meetings nearby. There weren't that many meetings around to start off. They'd hustle us off to Providence, Rhode Island, or Worcester, Massachusetts. You know, I got in a car with the guys. I hated the ride. You know, there was about six guys. We were traveling at the time in an old Cadillac. Dick from the old Lowell group had it. You know, and they'd all sit in the car, you know, and they were all guys, right, you know, and they were the old timers, you know. They looked like drunks. You know, right? They had the bulbous noses and the, you know. I mean, you could have hung any one of them out front here and said, don't let this happen to you, join AA. And you know, here I am, I'm in this car, right? You know, I weigh 103 pounds. I'm like about 2 weeks off my last drunk. I'm quivering, I'm quaking, I'm falling apart. You got no sympathy from me. None, absolutely, positively no. Understanding, yes, but no sympathy. Their attitude was, you bought for it, you paid it. You bought it and you paid for it. You enjoy it, right? You know, you'll get better. Just sit there and take it easy. You know, and the claustrophobia would come over me, and we'd be sitting in that Cadillac. You know, we looked like the mafia on the way to a hit, you know? And when I got to the meeting, I'd pace around the back of the hall, and all I could think of was the ride home. That's all I could think of, you know. Geez, I got to go through the same goddamn thing going back home, you know. And when I got back to Lowell, you know, I tell them, drop me off here, and they drop me off, and they say, we'll pick you up tomorrow night right out at the corner there, and don't forget to be there, and we'll be there at 7:15. And I say, okay, I'll be there. And I get out of the car, and I say, I will never, ever, ever get in that automobile again. Goodbye, good luck, and good riddance, right? And then I'd walk the streets of Lowell, and I'd go to all the joints. I wouldn't go inside. I'd just peek in to make sure the bottles were still there, right? You know? I wanted to know they were still serving it. I wanted to know that it was still there, that relief was only a swallow away. I knew I couldn't drink because they told me, don't drink, don't take pills, don't do this, hang in there, right? I went on like this for 90 days. 90 days, right? At the end of 90 days, I could not take one more minute. I could not take one more minute. I had got a job in a band working down at Salisbury Beach, right? It was April 1st of that particular year. I know it was April 1st because I'm not good on dates or anything else, but that's when the seasonal license opened up, and I was there on April 1st. And I couldn't stand it any longer. My nerves were bad. I was 35 miles from home. I couldn't face it. I said, this is what sobriety is. I just can't hack it. I can't hack sobriety. This is what I got to go through. The hell with it. I'd rather be drunk. And I went over to the bartender. I ordered a double shot of Corby's because that's what I always drank. And a beer. And I remember taking it. I remember drinking it. I ordered a second double shot. I don't remember taking that one. The next thing I consciously remember, and you can believe this or not, I was in Norfolk, Virginia, and it was the 4th of July weekend. And that's a blackout. And I don't know what the hell went on between then and, you know, the 4th of July weekend. But I woke up in a doorway down there with a guy. He had a bottle of Paregoric. I split the bottle of Paregoric. We got something else to drink. And I went back into another blackout. The next thing I knew, I was in Marion Johnson's in Dublin, New Hampshire. It was the 17th day of July, 1961. And I was about as beat as you could possibly get. There was no hope for me. None. None. I had tried AA. It didn't work. Right? I couldn't stand being sober, but I couldn't stand being drunk. There was absolutely no hope. My life was gone. My life was gone on that day, almost 17 years ago. But you see, Alcoholics Anonymous works for anybody who has the smallest desire to do something about their booze problem. And because of that, I can stand here tonight almost 17 years later and tell you I haven't had a drink or a substitute since that day. Right? Is that a miracle? Bet your ass it's a miracle. Right? There's no rhyme or reason on the face of this earth why I'm here. No rhyme or reason. So the reason and the rhyme has to come from outside the face of this earth, right? And it works through people like you at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Right? There's a power in this room tonight. You can call the power God, you can call the power anything you want to call it. I'm not concerned with it. I call it faith. Faith is a very basic, simple thing. Right? And don't, if you think I'm a religious fanatic, right, you'll find out I'm not, so don't turn me off yet. Right? So, you know, a lot of people, when you reach that word, you see they go click, and they shut you off, right? Don't turn me off yet. Right? I want to tell you how I think about faith. Okay? I remember the time I was walking the streets of Lowell, this one particular time. It was a horror night. It was a panic-stricken horror night. I'll never forget it. I've been through a lot of them, but this one was seemed to be more intense, you know. The anxiety was more intense. The terror was more intense. I don't know where I was coming from or where I was going to, but I found myself walking the streets of Lowell. I had no booze, and I had no money. There was no way I was going to get any booze. And with each step I took, I knew that that was going to be the last one. I knew I was going to die. My heart was racing. My mind was racing. My blood pressure had to be up. You know, I was an absolute raving maniac. I had to get a drink at all costs. That was the only thing that was going to save my life. I imagine it's much like a person being in a heart attack, you know, the panic of me. I'm dying, man. I got to get a drink. And I pounded on barroom doors and everything else. And I didn't even know what time it was. You know, it was probably 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Everything was closed. No way to get a drink. And I went to this one barroom door and I pounded on the door. And a guy opened the door. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I got to have a drink." He said, "Screw." But I did what I had to do, you see. I begged. I said, "No, you don't understand, man, right? I got to have a drink. I got to have a drink, man. You know, you're my last shot. You can't turn me down, man. I got to have a drink. Please. Whatever good is in you, please don't say no. Give me a shot. Anything. I got to have a drink." He went inside, he came back out, and he gave me a fifth of booze. A fifth. You know what a fifth of booze is like at that moment? Right? It's like a million ice cream cones to a two-year-old. He gave me a fifth of booze, you know? I looked at it, and it was there, and it was gold, and it was beautiful, you know? And instantly, man, I started feeling that strength. You know, the heartbeat went right back down to where it was supposed to be, you know? The blood pressure dropped right down. The strength came right through me. The warmth, you could feel it, man, going right through you. You know, serenity, peace of mind. I had it all. I suppose a smile even crossed my face, you know. It's going to be a good day. Now, what transformed me from that raving, panic-struck, terror-struck animal to a supposedly serene person? The booze? No. It wasn't the booze. You see, because I hadn't even taken the cap off the bottle. Faith. I simply believed that what was in that jug was going to work for me. And because I believed it was going to work for me, it worked. And that's the secret behind the program of AA. If you'll simply come in here, I know what your troubles are. We all know what your troubles are. We know how it is to be panic-struck, how it is to be anxious, how it is to be nervous, how it is to be fearful, how it is to be depressed. We know all those things. We've all been through it. Look around you tonight. Each and every person in this hall tonight who is an alcoholic, right, is a hopeless, helpless drunk. Right up here in their head. Because that's where hopelessness is. And that's where helplessness is. That's where Skid Row is. Each and every one of us knew that there was no way out. And yet we're all here tonight and we're all sober. And the reason we're sober is we simply believe that what was in this program would work for us if we did our share. If we did our share. I said in the beginning, if you're an alcoholic, this program will work for you. The toughest thing you have to do is make up your mind, are you or are you not an alcoholic? I told you a story of a degenerate that went down to the gutter. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. I'll tell you right now. I told you a story of the first drink. When I poured it inside of me, and that stuff went right through me, and I felt great. That's when I became an alcoholic. I could have come in, I know that today, I could have come in the program right then had I had the only requirement for membership, a desire to stop drinking. I'd have had the chintziest story in the program, but... I could have come in, you see, right? There are no degrees of alcoholism. I could have saved myself all that trouble, but I didn't know I was an alcoholic. If you're here tonight, we need you. We want you. You're the lifeblood of AA, the newcomer, and the old-timer, and all those in between. We're the chosen people, not because we're super intellectuals, or not because we're super egotistical, or not because, simply because we're drunks. When the power behind this universe chose to give this gift of helping another alcoholic to a person, he chose to give it to another drunk. He didn't give it to the people who are knowledgeable, and he gave it to another drunk. He gave it to him for one day, if we were willing to share our experience, strength, and hope with another human being, and pass it on. AA works. AA works because of the people in AA. I hear a lot of talk nowadays about, you know, other groups, AWOL, this, that. So I hear a lot of people talking them down, talking down step meetings, talking this down. Nothing going to happen to AA. Nothing going to happen to AA. Because the power behind the program will make sure nothing happens to AA. I'll close by saying this. I can't guarantee you sobriety. Nobody can guarantee you sobriety. If there was guaranteed sobriety, we wouldn't have any AA meetings. But I can guarantee you this. If you come into this program, and if you will simply get honest with yourself about what your problem is, if you will simply read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in there is the answer. Right? Don't listen to all the other stuff that you hear around you, the conversation, fast effort. You've got to go all the way. You can't make excuses for not going to meetings. You've got to attend meetings, particularly in the beginning. It's so important to get in and get this thing. You know, I hear people say 30 meetings in 30 days. That supposes that you're projecting for 30 days, doesn't it?
That does to me.
Right? One meeting today, because today is the only day you got. I know this. There's two things in this world that you've got going for you today. The same two things that I got going for me today. The same two things that I had going for me 17 years ago that took me from where I was then to where I am now. I've got myself, right? And I've got today. Those are the only two things I got in this world that are of any importance. I'm here for today, and I've got myself. Now, it's what I do with myself today that's going to determine how I live the rest of my life and how good my past is or how good my future may be. You can do it, you see. Break it down to little pieces. Get up in the morning. If you're here tonight and you're having trouble with booze, you never have to drink again. I'm telling you that. I'm not telling it to you because I read it in a book. I'm telling it to you because I lived it. Sure, there's a price you got to pay. What the hell? We all know that. You know, I hear people out there say, I'm very nervous. Too goddamn bad. You bought and you paid for the shake. Sit back, relax, and enjoy it. People take pills nowadays because they don't want to shake. That ain't going to get you. You're going to stand on your own 2 feet somewhere along the line and grow up. Right? You've got to pay that price, whatever the price might be. And if the price is a bad case of nerves, too bad. If you're shaking, you know, I'm amazed at people who don't want to shake. It's part of the recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there are literally hundreds of thousands of dead alcoholics today. They're laying in their grave. They're 6 feet under. They're planted. They're like this. They'd give anything to get up and have one more shake. Depression. I hear,
I hear people talk about depression.
I'm depressed.
So what? So you're depressed. How many people have you depressed down through your life? You know, you bought and paid for it. Depression isn't the worst thing in the world. You know, you'll come out the other side. Alcoholics tend to be people who get depressed and people who get exhilarated. You know, they go the whole spectrum of life. Caleb Gilbron, who wrote The Prophet, said, you know, at least a person who has all the highs and who has all the lows gets to cry all his tears and laugh all his laughs. The mundane person goes on like this, they really don't know what it's all about. Thank God we're not mundane. Thank God we can live. And I came in this program to live. That's why I came. If you're here tonight for the first time or the first few times, you get up tomorrow morning, you don't take a drink. You ask a power greater than yourself whether you believe in that power or not. It doesn't make any difference whether you believe. You ask that power to help you through this day without a drink or a substitute. And you have a little blind faith that it will work. You get the names of people in the program. You call them up sober, not drunk. You call them up sober. And if you're having trouble at 3 o'clock in the morning, call them up at 3 o'clock in the morning sober and tell them I'm having trouble. And if they hang the phone up on you, stay sober for 3 months, get up here, speak, and point the bastards out. AA is people helping people. It isn't groups helping people. You know, you can't shove away that sponsorship. Sure, the step meetings are there, but you can't put that sponsorship away. It's one-on-one, you see. It's one person helping another person. You know, it's the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous is my hand. It's Gil's hand. It's your hand. It's everybody's hand. That's the hand of AA. You don't negate that responsibility. We only got what we've got because it was a gift to us. The only way we can keep it is to give it away. If you become willing a day at a time to do those things, and if you'll thank at the end of the day, if you'll tough it out and pay the price regardless of how difficult it is, if you'll do all those things and then become willing to share your experience, strength, and hope with another human being, if you do all of these things, I'll guarantee you, one day of sobriety. That's all. One day of sobriety. But one day of sobriety is enough. Because if you're a drunk like I'm a drunk, one day of sobriety, one day is the most precious gift the loving God can give a drunk. Thank you.